Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and we have another two-hour Zero Point radio show. I welcome back previous listeners, and I hope we have a growing audience of people out there who are taking in the show and getting others to listen in. My background is as a clinical and forensic psychologist, and I studied mystical spiritual teachings for 30 years. And through my life, at different times, I've been most influenced by different teachings. Initially, as a graduate student in psychology, I became heavily involved in the Gurdjieff Uspensky teaching, and that was my predominant focus for about 5 to 10 years, and I was a psychologist and interested in the issues of human consciousness, and Gurdjieff had a whole alternative way of approaching the issues of consciousness. And from the Gurdjieff teaching, I became interested in the Krishna consciousness movement and the Bhagavad Gita and yogic teachings, and began to realize the concept of what I now call the heart doctrine, that a human being has some form of divine or spiritual element connected to the human heart. And over time, as I studied this idea of the heart doctrine, I realized that this teaching was embodied in all these different varied teachings. So in Christianity, it is said Christ is within the heart, or by the pure of heart come to know God. Or in Sufism, where Rumi goes wandering to find God, and he goes to the temple and the pagodas and the highlands and the lowlands, and then Rumi at the end of his poem says, "And finally I found him in his only place within mine own heart." In the Gita, the Jiva Atma, the individual self, an individual I element, is said to reside within the heart. Both the Jiva Atma, meaning the infinitesimally small spiritual spark or spiritual soul, as well as the Paramatma, the infinite soul, are both connected to the dimensions of the heart. So the heart doctrine is found in Christianity, it's in Judaism, where the three superior supernal spheres, their influences come down into Tiferet, the central sphere in the tree of life, and that is embodied in the heart. So it's in Christianity, Judaism, it's in Tibetan Buddhism of the Dalai Lama, who explains concepts about the indestructible drop within the heart and how all life grows out from that drop. He says there are 72,000 channels or nadi which grow out from the heart, and consciousness comes to pervade the body, but it all emerges within without through this higher dimensional physics of the human heart. And then over time, and through my life for now 25 years, I've been studying the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky, who is the most prominent occult scholar of the past century or so of Western civilization. Blavatsky was an amazing individualist who brought Eastern teachings to the West and introduced Western audience to Eastern mystical teachings. And she also introduced Western audiences to our own mystical tradition, as she was so widely studied in Kabbalistic teachings and Chaldean and Zoroastrian and all these different religions and Western traditions. So Blavatsky, I call her a holy world star for her, especially for her book, The Secret Doctrine, which is my primary interest, is book one of The Secret Doctrine on cosmogenesis, dealing with the creation of the universe, according to what Blavatsky calls the perennial wisdom teachings, or the divine wisdom teachings of theosophy. So that's my particular interest area, interested in creation physics. It's one aspect of what we explore in this show, and we explore the issues of human consciousness, trying to understand the heart doctrine, and I'm attempting to explicate a model of the physics and higher dimensional physics of the human heart. See, I'm saying there's an actual science to this all, and it's Blavatsky provided a model of a holographic universe. She wrote in The Secret Doctrine, deity is in every point of the universe. So the concept is that we have such a point of the deity within us. Blavatsky would call that the monad. Okay, so in the last three or four shows now, we've focused on the teachings of theosophy and the work of Blavatsky and their relationship to science and psychology. And we'll gain today, we have two guests on, both members of the United Lodge of Theosophists. And I'll introduce them in a moment. The first will be speaking about the recently passed conference, and I hope some of the listeners took in the live broadcast last week from the conference. Unfortunately, we got cut off at some point. So, but then fortunately, again, there was a video audio recording of the session, and it was really quite magical session I had with Judy Saltzman, who we'll have on a future show. Anyway, so my name's Christopher Holmes. This is Zero Point Radio. The concept Zero Point is taken from Blavatsky's work, the idea that a zero point is something so small it kind of disappears from view. And her teaching is that all living beings have such zero point centers. We're trying to explore this concept as well as other ideas from theosophy and mystical studies. My website is at www.zeropoint.ca, and I have a variety of books there for sale, and yeah, and try to share as much as I can of my work. Okay, so I'm pleased to be back, and in the mic, I'd like to introduce first co-host James Moffitt. James, Jim, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi, Chris.
How are you, Jim?
I'm good. Unfortunately, as you said, you know, I was listening to your broadcast from California, and it got cut off because it was just getting really interesting. And you know, hope to see the videotape at some point, or to you know, to hear the entire discussion, because it sounded very interesting.
It really was. It was excellent, and the lady who I interviewed in the show, Judy Saltzman, she talks about the work of Dawkins and such on kind of evolution and design and the issue. So it was so pertinent to my own interest areas.
Right.
Yeah, I've actually asked her now to review my book and maybe provide some comment on it, you know, for the book cover when it comes out and such.
Yeah, I think that I don't think actually that part was heard at all, because she hadn't actually been introduced yet unfortunately. So
yeah, I'm glad we got a recording of it. Yeah,
yeah,
and you'll hear it someday. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to make a comment, which was a couple actually. One was that that little review of kind of the history of your interest in esoteric and mystical teachings, and how you started with the Gurdjieff Uspensky material, and then got more interested in the Krishna consciousness and into yoga, and then sort of started to see the development of the heart doctrine through all these disciplines, and then started studying Blavatsky. It was kind of, I think, in part a reply to an email that I sent you earlier in the week, just talking about your work a bit, because I'm writing a book, the Problem of God's Contracting Universe, which addresses the history of your work and uses it as a contrast with Carl Sagan as representative of materialist, mechanistic, reductionistic science. And I like that you went back and addressed that, because it's fascinating. Kind of just what I'm trying to portray in part, in it's not the major part of the book, but one of the things that I think is so interesting is that in your own story, and in my own story, is that we've been discussing and studying and trying to make sense of this material now through studying ourselves and through reading and through lecturing and through writing for 25 years, and yet, you know, it's such a journey in terms of the unfolding of your levels of awareness and understanding of things on an intellectual level, but more, I think most pertinently, really on an emotional and conscious level, in terms of it, you would begin to incorporate it more and more into your being, and I think that's something that to my mind, all critics of mysticism and esotericism completely do not understand this. Well, I don't think they understand the teachings themselves, but I don't think they understand the incredible demands that it makes on somebody in terms of furthering your knowledge and understanding of these materials. Is quite an extraordinary journey.
Yeah, it is a venture, and it's so remarkable that Western theorists haven't grasped what for Gurdjieff was the most basic concept, like that psychology, he said, has to begin with self-study, especially as pertains to the study of consciousness, because you can never observe a consciousness as an object of your awareness. You can only know consciousness within yourself. So in order to study what is consciousness, we have to do it within ourself. And whereas the scientist thinks, oh, it's only a product of the material brain, and they analyze brains or they do cognitive tasks, but they never make that effort to study consciousness within themselves. And that is, and in a way, they dismiss self-study. They kind of say it's pseudoscientific or it's too subjective. But truly, the opposite is the case. It's truly pseudoscientific not to consider the nature of the perceiving organism when you're trying to understand the nature of reality, because you can't understand the world apart from the observer. So really, mystical teachings are more objective and truly scientific, I would argue, than the materialist perspective, which mainly dismissed consciousness for almost a century from modern psychology.
Absolutely. I think
you deal with that well in your writing.
It's interesting because I'm trying to kind of, you know, as I say, I'm trying to get the scope of the entire 25 years, and there's this incredible growth. There's this incredible growth in terms of your understanding of things. But as you say, that I would maintain exactly what you just said. That's precisely the case. Is that, as Gurdjieff says, the most basic point has eluded modern psychologists in the study of consciousness, is that you can only study it really, realistically and objectively in yourself. And really, everything comes from that, and from that basic premise. And I guess when I was writing the book, I was using I have a chapter on Carl Sagan and his work and the Dragons of Eden, where he provides a very materialistic, mechanistic explanation of consciousness, and says consciousness is basically what the brain does. That's his position. And I guess, you know, in the interest of, like, it's important to remember what you know and what you don't know, and on a certain level, I like to affect a certain impartiality and objectivity about things, but on the other hand, too, I kind of get more and more, as I survey all this, I get more and more annoyed, in a way, by the complete lack of intellectual integrity and curiosity of modern Western scientists when it comes to studying consciousness, because you have this vast literature of the esoteric and mystical tradition. This is thousands and thousands of years of efforts by people to know themselves by studying consciousness, and yet modern science completely ignores this material. It'd be one thing if someone had actually studied it and could critique it and show it where it's wrong, but that's precisely not the case. And I would argue, you know, very strongly that really, as you say, I think, you know, your point is well taken. I would say that the study of consciousness, even though it's useful to study the brain externally through its operations and its activities and its structures and functions, that's really pseudoscientific when it comes to the study of consciousness, because you have to study consciousness within yourself, and not in a haphazard, willy-nilly fashion. You have to do it systematically in terms of some sort of a teaching to organize your observations and organize your understanding so that you can integrate it and develop it into a comprehensive and coherent whole.
Yeah, and it seems to me like self-study immediately begins to show the mistakes made about the nature of consciousness.
Yes.
Like, I think if you approach self-study and you begin self-sensing and being aware in your being and being present and present in your breath, you come to realize that your consciousness is not simply something stuck up in the cortex in the brain. Like, it's just not. That's not our direct experience of ourselves. Like, I can experience myself at times now as a whole, and kind of, it feels like I'm in my blood through the whole of myself, my hands, my feet, my whole being. So my inner experience is of consciousness, is, I think, as I argue, connected to the blood flow, and consciousness can pervade the body. So it's not produced at neurological activity at all, but although you can be conscious and you obviously have cognitive functions in your mind, but that's not where all your consciousness is. The consciousness is something different than thinking and analyzing and cognizing. It's something deeper in us, and no one has addressed that deeper issue.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, you know, in your doctoral thesis, that why is it that Western thinkers, think about consciousness and think that consciousness is thinking. It's an illusion which is created by the way in which they approach the study of the subject and with the assumptive framework that they assume, which is that consciousness is somehow produced in the brain. But really, trying not to think or trying to learn how not to think is one of the primary methods in all Eastern esoteric and mystical approaches to developing consciousness, is to overcome what the Eastern sages call the monkeys of the mind, or the turning of the mind, which is the involuntary unconscious thinking which we all which happens to us all the time. And really, these are such simple experiments, but all you have to do is try to stop and not think. What should be simpler than not thinking? On the face of it, that should be the easiest thing in the world to do, but it's the most difficult thing to do, and that's an experiment anyone can undertake, you know, just by sitting and meditating. And as you say, anybody can have the experience of realizing that their consciousness, I mean, this idea that consciousness is related to the flow of the blood, it's just so important. And yet, when you read the contemporary discussions of consciousness, it's all in the head and the brain. It's like people are just these brains that use their bodies to get around town and feed themselves and have sex. But really, there's no kind of, you know, it's all in their heads, their head cases, and literally and figuratively, their head cases.
Yeah, as you say, I mean, they have that cognitive mental focus, and that's how they examine consciousness, and so that they end up equating consciousness with all the thinking and imagining and cognitive activities, whereas mystical teaching suggests there's a deeper self that underlies this egoic mind process. Blavatsky says, hey, I'll just read a quote from... She says, from The Voice of Silence, she says, learn above all to separate head learning from soul wisdom.
Oh, yeah.
The eye from the heart doctrine.
Wow.
Yeah, that's really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, so and it is neat, like, to have this focus in life, even, to have this idea of, like, trying to understand, know who we are. Like, we've been on a mystical path for 30 years to kind of come to know ourselves, and what a process that is, and how I can see in ways that Gurdjieff teaching was the most practical and valuable to encounter first, because it gave practical methods of self-remembering and how to develop awareness and the parts of our being and things like that. And then that, over time, kind of helps you understand other esoteric teachings.
It dispels so many fundamental illusions, I think. And for me, I think I would never have had the power. I would never have been as attracted to other esoteric and mystical teachings if I hadn't, because I'm a scientist by training. If I hadn't had been able to verify these things by studying these processes and these assertions in myself, and then I began to realize, well, yeah, you know, people are fundamentally mistaken about so many aspects of what the nature of the self and the I and consciousness and awareness, and even like the idea that we're just a single brain being. Like, I mean, I think that's an incredibly important idea in Gurdjieff's, in the fourth way teaching, is that the idea that we're multi-brain beings, which in turn leads to the idea that, well, maybe consciousness doesn't arise in our brain, but rather arises somewhere else. And as you discovered, and again, you know, this is so amazing, is that you find it in all these teachings, and yet nobody in modern thought seems to recognize the idea that consciousness originates in the heart. I think people think it, if they know about it, they probably think it's metaphorical.
Yeah, I think a little bit they do. Like Zhukov's book says that, the seed of the soul.
Yeah.
He talks about the soul connected to the heart, and
right.
He talks about things like having compassion and feelings in the heart, but he doesn't consider it as a serious scientific hypothesis in relation to the issue of the origins of consciousness. Like, what could be the physics of the self within the heart? What is the science of it?
Right.
And that's what's so valuable, because if we go to the esoteric literature, we get a lot of valuable insights into how to understand this concept of the self within the heart, like consciousness related to light, the idea of there being higher dimensional space which sustains lower dimensional space, consciousness as a form of nothingness, and how it's similar to space, in a way, consciousness is this form of nothingness that allows us to be aware of all the things.
Now,
so if there wasn't this kind of null thing, then we couldn't be aware of things.
Things,
yeah. Blavatsky has such a useful distinction between what she, well, in Hinduism, it's called Purusha and Prakriti.
Right.
Spirit and matter. So consciousness is on the spirit side, and it kind of illuminates, and then matter is different bodies we might have, different realms of nature. So that distinction, whereas Western psychology has never seen consciousness as Purusha, it's only thought it was produced by Prakriti. And so there's that fundamental distinction. In esotericism, consciousness has this kind of special higher dimensional origin and nature.
And I think that, you know, that's the one of the fundamental features of the esoteric and mystical tradition is the idea that there's this great, well, Lovejoy calls it the great chain of being, Ken Wilber calls it the great nest of being, but that there's these higher order dimensions and that they subsume and incorporate the lower dimensions, but they add something to it, and that, like that idea that you're talking about, Purusha and Prakriti. You know, the other thing I was going to mention was that a few weeks ago when we were talking, and Odin was on with us, and I asked Odin, and I said, do you know of other theorists who deal with the kind of issues that Chris is dealing with in his work, and he mentioned Friedrich Capra's Tao of Physics and the work of Irvin Laszlo. And I didn't know Irvin Laszlo's work, but I found out that I actually had one of his books, and I read it. It's called Science and the Reenchantment of the Cosmos. Very interesting book. The subtitle is The Rise of the Integral Vision of Reality. And he deals with a variety of paradoxes and questions from all sorts of different scientific disciplines, and tries to relate them to the idea of the Akashic field in ancient esoteric teachings, and says that there's a field of intelligence which informs material reality. And very interesting material. But one thing that really struck me in reading his book, and I'm reading another one of his books, is that when it comes to discussing consciousness, he subscribes to the head doctrine, I would say, that there's no recognition, and I would say the same with Capra, that there's no recognition in either of them of the heart doctrine, and the idea of the manifestation of consciousness through the heart, and what the idea of higher dimensionality, realities, stepping down and materializing on the physical plane.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he lacks that element.
And I think that's, I was trying to sort of set you up a little bit when I asked Odin that question, but what I think is really unique in your work, and I think I've seen it nowhere else, is this idea of the heart doctrine, and then taking it even one further step further in terms of Madame Blavatsky's teaching and the zero point, and how the zero point is a nexus or a gateway between different planes, and is applicable on all different levels of the cosmos. I think that's quite an astonishing hypothesis.
It's like an alternate model of the nature of reality.
Completely.
That's what it is.
Completely.
And it takes time to grok it, like to really comprehend what it means, and that's a long process even to understand it. Yeah. We should move along, and we'll introduce Odin Townley here. Odin is a member of the United Lodge of Theosophists in New York City, and Odin was the primary person who set up the conference and arranged to have it videoed and filmed. And Odin, are you there, sir?
Hello, Kristen.
Hi, Odin. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for having me on again.
Pleasure to have you back.
Nice to talk to you again. We haven't talked since we were in the hills of Petaluma.
Yeah, that was quite something. I got a good picture of you, your son, and your grandson. I hope you received that.
I got them, and they're just great.
Yeah, it's cool.
Good memories. Hi, James. How are you?
I'm good. I'm having a little bit of difficulty hearing you, Odin. Nice to talk to you, and I wish I could have been there with you guys in California. It sounded like a really interesting time.
No, it was terrific, and all the speakers this was like Wu Wei. We never expected it to happen, but how they all blended into each other and supported the fundamental concepts that we were all talking about, you know, the separation of mind and matter and the heart doctrine.
A real excitement among people there. I think
they were just rooted to their seats. it was quite really extraordinary to see so many people focused on these teachings in such a meaningful way and with such a powerful energy all around us there. I think it had to do with not only yourself and the other amazing speakers, but also the fact that we felt the real presence of Blavatsky being there. And you spoke on her on the eve of her birthday, didn't you, Chris?
Yeah, yes, that was so wonderful. I didn't know that at the time, but I found out you judge her. I think I ended about 10:30 that night, and it was her birthday. You take us 12 o'clock on that night. Yeah, that was thrilling in a way that, I got to speak on her birthday.
It really made, I think that's one of the virtues of having this particular conference every year at her birthday, takes advantage of the occult fact that she's not dead, number one, and that her presence can be felt. And I think, there's much more to her than people realize, not just a metaphysical writer, but actually a representative of the great masters of wisdom. And that comes through when you talk about heart doctrine and you get as deep into it, into the zero points as you do, that really kind of lights a match and sets the whole thing afire. It's terrific. And I was very, very appreciative that you could make it to the conference.
Yeah, well, it's valuable to bring out that relatively obscure aspects of Blavatsky's work, wouldn't you say, Odin? Like the zero point teaching, and like it's only in light of modern physics that we can realize what a profound concept she was trying to articulate.
Yes. The Buddha had his head doctrine and heart doctrine as well. I think it's said that his metaphysical teachings emanated from his head, and the heart doctrine emanated from his heart.
Wow, that's it.
And this is similar to really Jesus, having a doctrine for the eye and a doctrine for the heart, one for his disciples and one for the world. And I think becoming a disciple is not something where you get a crown put on your head in some kind of artificial ceremony, but it's sort of a becoming, a process where you actually become a disciple without even realizing.
I see it as that process of self-realization and then illumination, and in a way like the aura or the crown upon the head is you're initiated through the experiences of that, those experiences of that.
The word metaphysics is interesting. Blavatsky used it a lot, and she even had another term which she used, I think, was called metaphysics.
Oh, yeah, metaphysics.
And then she says, of course, we don't talk about it much today, but there is a meta-psychology, and I think that whole, our whole conference was built around this notion of a meta-psychology.
And it's interesting in modern science, like what's happened in modern science, like scientists used to believe that there was just matter and energy in four-dimensional space-time, and that was our physics.
Yeah.
Matter and energy in four-dimensional space-time. But in the newest physics, they now think that every point in four-dimensional space-time, there's a seven-dimensional hypersphere. So there's this whole metaphysics, I would call that, like they're getting to that metaphysical realm, postulating this higher dimension, seven-dimensional hyperspace underlying material reality. And that's like what Blavatsky was talking about, the seven-skinned eternal parent space. So modern science is kind of coming to this metaphysics, though they won't want to call it that because they're worried that it'll mix it with mysticism or something.
I was just reading, and as you say, they mix it up with mysticism, but if there ever was mysticism in the world today that you could put your finger on and point to science, you look at CERN, you look at Fermilab. What are they doing? They're trying to explode apart matter so they can see what's in there, and they're worse off than when they started. They get all excited about finding these new particles, and they have these you know, these mysterious particles that they're trying to establish as being a fact and to actually see them. But, you know, the instead of these huge generators blasting the matter apart with laser energy, if they would just consider the possibility that we ourselves, each individual, is a kind of a generator of force, much greater force, actually, than any laser or any explosion of atomic power.
And that we can actually explore those realms within ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And we'd see all the particles we need to see. And I think probably we'd probably be a little bit blown away by the vision of it. And Blavatsky says that the universe, as you know, I think you could have quoted that in your book, Within Without, from Zero Points, that the universe is worked and guided from within outwards.
Yeah.
And above, so is below, and as in heaven, so on earth. And the main key of that, I think, in her conclusion there, is that man in all caps, is the microcosm and miniature copy of the universe, of the macrocosm. And he is really the living witness to this, as she says, this universal law of consciousness as being in every point of the universe. That was one of the great things that I thought, Christopher, that you brought out, that was one of the outstanding aha moments, was when you pointed out that we are all zero points.
Yeah, we all have, all living beings that have zero point centers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really something you really need to meditate on a lot, but it's striking.
Yeah.
It brings home this the fundamental notion that we're not physical beings, but we're using prakriti, as you said, prakriti. Purusha is using prakriti. And really, what I find fascinating is the idea that Purusha actually produces prakriti in a sense. In other words, it finds a way of expressing itself. And that's what we call our bodies. That's what we call our brains. They're just mechanisms whereby consciousness can find a way of expressing itself on a certain layer of substance in the universe. So here we are in this fourth plane of substance, as Blavatsky says, and we have fourth plane material instruments to work through. But to say, I think as James pointed out, to have the audacity to say that the spirit or this force or this energy or consciousness arises and as a product of those vehicles is like saying, well, the driver of a car came out of the car.
That's good. That's a nice analogy. I like that. Yeah, the car produced the driver.
Yeah, right. That's the whole deal. They've got it completely backwards.
Yeah.
So, you know, sure, they look like they're inseparable, and God help us if they're not inseparable, at least while a car is in motion. But to think that we come as drivers out of the substance and of the instruments that we use is—it's
funny. It's unfortunate that science takes that perspective that the I or the inner being is produced by material processes and presents it as though it's a scientific conclusion. That's what is most upsetting in a way. Well, really, it's their assumption and their dogma, but it's not established by any kind of empirical observation or datum. It's simply not. They promise, like they have what I call promissory science. Well, they don't understand it yet, but they're sure that if they examine the brain long enough, they promise that they'll come up with the answer. But
yeah,
they don't come up with the answer. And they're led endlessly to different perplexities and things they can't explain.
Well, we say it's true, so all we have to do is just to find a way to prove it. Instead of as the scientific method really dictates, the pure scientific method is that you follow the evidence wherever it leads. And
yeah.
If it leads you out of your little physical box into some other area, if you're an honest scientist, you follow it.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I think, you know, like people, work of people like Radin is so important. Like Radin, he goes into the scientific evidence. He does meta-analyses of all these different areas of parapsychological research, and you realize the evidence is there. So really,
there's too much evidence, actually.
There's
much more evidence than we really need.
Yeah, in a way, it's kind of been proven, you know, a thousand times over. So, in a way, I think now what we need to do is say, okay, there is evidence that we are multidimensional beings. There's evidence for multiple lives, afterlife states, and such.
And
so now we've got to ask, how does it work? And we've got to try to develop an understanding of how it works, not trying to prove all the time to kind of skeptic naysayers. We don't need to prove it to them anymore. We need to, instead, in a positive way, articulate how this could work. And then we come to things like Blavatsky's work with this most profound occult scholar.
Well, that's why string theory is struggling still so hard to get a foothold in modern physics, because it's too far out there for the material mind. The skeptics, it leads us into other dimensions and other worlds, and yet we're in those dimensions every moment in our lives. We have feelings and emotions. What is love? What is a thought? You can't define that. That's pure metaphysics, and that's pure metapsychology. But it's funny how we just, our focus is always external. It's a natural thing because, you know, we're looking, as we're driving, we're looking to make sure that we're, you know, not going to bump into somebody else, and we're checking the cross streets, or we're reading the map, and we're trying not to, you know, go through any red lights and obey all the rules. So our focus is all out there. It's all focused on, you know, the actions that we're taking and the material things that we can see, touch, taste, smell, feel. Those other senses that we have, those other, right, actually, Theosophy and Blavatsky says we have two other senses that are emerging gradually more and more now, the higher senses, which will open up the universe, will suddenly become much more visible to us. We'll see all of these other fields and energies that are going surrounding us. Instead of trying to say, well, gee, this must relate to some other sense that I have. Love is not something that I can quantify. A thought, a pure thought, in and of itself, is not something I can put in the test tube and analyze. So it has to relate to some other state of consciousness.
Yeah.
But we're afraid to look at those states.
Yeah.
It's so inconsistent, too, because even within science, I mean, pure mathematics is completely, you know, it's not external, it's not sensory motor, it's a faculty of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's produced by a faculty of the mind. It's like Maurice Nicol, the fourth wave scholar and esoteric scholar, talks about, that really the sense-based mind, the world that it portrays is so attractive, but it's really a lower level of mind, and that's what's so hard for people to overcome. And yet, you know, on a whole other level, everything in 20th century physics has taught us that we have to go beyond that. That's the ultimate irony, you know, is that in looking for the building blocks of matter, physics has kind of come to the point of realizing, well, it's not real. It's a quest that can't be fulfilled, and so that we have to kind of look beyond that. And that's what Eddington and Sir James Jeans and Heisenberg and almost all the great physicists of the first half of the 20th century kind of came to the viewpoint that, if nothing else, physics had revealed that science couldn't really disprove a mystical viewpoint. And in Eddington's case, he said that really to go beyond where science was, you needed the mystical viewpoint.
Yeah.
It's interesting. There's a quote from Groff. I don't know if you have this one, Chris, where he says that at a certain point, this is Stanislav Groff, at a certain point of its development, not clearly identified by mechanistic science, matter, previously inert and blind, suddenly became aware of itself. Although the mechanism involved in this miraculous event entirely escapes even the crudest attempt at speculation, it is taken for granted and represents a fundamental postulate of the materialistic and mechanistic worldview.
Is that from his holotropic mind?
I found it in a, I think it's in a an essay he wrote in a book called that he edited called The Ancient Wisdom and Modern Science.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's probably taken. It probably is in the holotropic mind too. But I mean that's the essence of the question right there. Is that, you know, if you're going to be a materialist, how do you explain life and mind? They're inexplicable, really, in terms of matter.
Yeah, science always goes so far, and then it discovers unresolved enigmas or gaps in their knowledge. Like, there's a gap. We can't explain consciousness. That's one. We can't explain the generation of the heartbeat by the physics of the heart. Like, that's inexplicable. So we say it's self-inherent, but there's no explanation of it. You know, we can't explain psychical phenomena. So there's all these gaps, like things that we can't fit into the materialist perspective. And even as you're saying, Jim, the new physics itself belies a materialistic perspective. So when the materialists say that we're taking a leap of faith that there's mind within the cosmos, really that's the same direction science has moved now to confirm that.
Yeah, you know, like, I'm with James. I mean, I'm really astounded when I read some of these papers that are trying to. It's like, it reminds me, these scientists, some of them, and I must say there are some very extraordinary scientists out there doing fantastic work. And of course, folks like Radin, who's trying to connect quantum physics to the supernatural states and of mind, is doing it a tremendous service. Because that's just what science needs, what it gets, you know, where it can sink its teeth into. Okay, you proved it, and this relates to this. And we need to do more of that, as you said, Christopher.
Yeah.
But it reminds me that I read some of these guys that, you know, it's the farmer that's suddenly wakes up and he slept all through the spring and summer, and he says, oh my goodness, I have these seeds. I didn't plant them yet. And he runs outside and digs a hole in the snow, and when takes a hammer and pounds the seeds into the ground, and he's determined to make them grow. And we know that he's not going to have a crop, but they're going to keep pounding those seeds into the frozen ground anyway, even though I think a lot of them suspect that they're not going to get any crop out of it. So it's sad in a way, but maybe it's a transition period, like the master said. HBB's teacher said, this is a transition period. Humanity is going through a lot of struggles. There's going to be struggles between science and between religions. We're going to have all of these troubles and difficulties getting through to the next level of consciousness. And sure enough, I think those predictions are starting to come through, and they've been coming through for the last few decades.
Yeah. I think we see what's resulted in our civilization from the lack of any soul science in modern times, like any concept that education should involve the awakening of consciousness and the heart, like this idea in education. Like we've denied spirit and soul for a century, and now they need to be brought back into science, and we need to explore these areas, which are in a way are the most subtle and complex, but yeah. We're more ready for it at this time, because I think we have come to understand material nature. Like quantum theory and physics explains, you know, all the kind of phenomena of nature now. It's only as we come to the ultimate causes that it kind of leads us into a broader mystical perspective.
Yeah, well, at the turn of the century, Blavatsky said there's going to be this conflagration of consciousness, and we're going to find, science is going to discover that what they thought was solid matter is no longer solid, and sure enough, she predicted that the atom is a metaphysical point, and as we know, and that it is infinitely divisible. Well, this was completely against science in the 1800s.
Yeah,
but now we, of course, the turn of the century. She said everything's going to change, and then it did. The discovery of these subtle energies penetrating matter, like X-rays, opened the whole door to the penetrability of matter, and no longer was a solid, no longer like a. Universe is no longer built of little marbles like we were played with when we were kids. But those marbles actually are just centers of consciousness, and they have many, many different layers in them. So it's just it's wonderful to read Blavatsky just from that point of view, to see all the predictions that she made about the coming centuries and the transition period, which we're in right now.
Yeah,
it's kind of interesting, because that's one thing that always strikes me about the skeptics who are really materialists and mechanists. And you know, Sagan in The Varieties of Scientific Experience, his Gifford Lectures on Natural Theology, which was presented at, where is that, I think University of Edinburgh. Anyway, that's where William James had given the same lectures, and that's where the variety of religious experiences come from. And Sagan says about religion, well, the problem with religion is that it doesn't really predict anything that I know of that's turned out to be true. But
he says that, really.
Well, yeah, but see, like, this is the problem, is that these guys are always fighting fundamentalists who believe, like Bishop Usher, that the world is 4,000 years old, or creationists who believe in the young earth, and fundamentalists a variety of religious stripes who are quite wrong about a lot of things. And when it comes to stacking up against science, I mean, they're just wrong. I mean, there's no question in my mind that they're wrong.
Yeah.
But the point is that really esotericism and mysticism is way beyond and much more coherent, complex, and incisive and insightful about things. And all sorts of predictions, well, like as Odin just said in Blavatsky, I mean, every major religious tradition at its esoteric core has the idea of the Trinity. And now we're finding matter, energy, and information, or consciousness, or awareness, whatever you want to characterize it, is at the heart of things. And I mean, there are all sorts of predictions that run through these teachings, like
well, Blavatsky predicted the origin of the universe from a singularity point.
Yeah,
that's the best example.
It's in that quote that Jonathan Cott has with the
rabbi there.
The rabbi about the rabbi of the 14th century, who's talking about the universe emerging from a singularity point source, you know, a source of light. I mean, there's so many examples that it's completely ridiculous to suggest that. I mean, you can say that the Gurdjieff's laws of seven really is describing quantum discontinuity. Like you know, it was anticipating, it anticipated what was happening when he was giving those lectures. But these are ideas that are thousands of years old. So it's absolutely absurd to say that these teachings don't predict things.
Yeah, they predicted all kinds of things.
Yeah,
exactly.
And that's what I think people don't realize it. But and in part of the problem is because there are so many, you know, I would say unconscious or mechanical religious interpretations that tend to get all the spotlight. Like, you know, the idea, like I say, Bishop Usher in the 19th century calculating that the universe had originated on a Tuesday afternoon 4,004 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, that's clearly absurd. That's ridiculous.
It's funny, too, about that. I've always thought the fact that it was like 4,000 years ago, in symbolically, it might be taken as the idea that we're related, we're in the fourth cycle,
mm-hmm.
because Blavatsky teaches that.
I don't think he meant that.
But there might be, he arrives at that through looking at the generation in the Bible.
Yeah.
So sometimes these things are symbolic. So I always thought that she said, 4,000 years B.C., that the world was created. So symbolically, you could take that we're in the fourth round, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and then there's that, too. I mean, because realistically, you can look at any scripture. I was rereading part of Maurice Nicol, who I mentioned earlier. He has a book called The New Man, which is an interpretation of the Gospels. And I don't know, Chris, if you've ever read anything.
Yeah, I have read that.
I know you've read it, but have you ever read anything that even remotely compares that in terms of its insight as an esoteric interpretation of the Gospels? I haven't read anything that's even close to it. I mean, that he puts everything in a completely different context, because he says, you know, when they're speaking about water and wine, they're not speaking about water and wine. You know, you can interpret these things literally, but they're speaking about them spiritually. These are symbols for truth and for the idea of self-transformation. And it's not talking, it's not talking at all about what people think that they're talking about. I've read a fair amount of commentary and interpretation of the Gospels. I've never seen anything that even remotely comes close to that in terms of, I would say, its depth and its insight. So that's always the that's always the challenge too. And I think that's sort of what's exciting about what's going on today, is I think more and more people are coming to deeper understandings about how these spiritual traditions relate to the teachings of modern science and how really they can inform modern science. And at the same time, modern science informs these teachings because it gives you a more comprehensive framework to understand, you know, what this might mean or
yeah.
what it's pointing towards.
You have the data almost to interpret the...
Yeah, exactly.
Don't you think, Odin, it's so unfortunate that the secret doctrine of Madame Blavatsky's work has just not been available within the higher educational system or so-called higher educational system. I've always thought, like, doesn't anyone in the...
Not there because we don't have a higher educational system.
Yeah, from this perspective, you don't,
no.
eh? We don't. I remember Swami Prabhupada says you study every department of knowledge except the most important one,
yeah.
the science of God consciousness.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, there's a lot of books about the God particle, God this, God that.
Yeah.
But, you know, Theosophy, Bill Blavatsky has been saying all along that God is everywhere. God is in every speck and atom of the universe. It's the zero point that you find everywhere around you. You know, I wanted to get back to a point that James made about Urban Laszlo. Now, I don't know if you read his new book or his latest book. No, it's not new, but it's fairly new compared to the one that you quoted from. And this one is titled Science and the Akashic Field.
Yeah, I'm actually reading that right now.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he refers to... what he calls the soft problem and the hard problem.
Mm-hmm.
The soft problem being, well, study of the brain itself and figuring out how it works and how the neurons go back and forth and how the blood surges into areas where the thought processes and emotions are occurring. He says, well, that's soft. The hard problem is, how do we figure out how consciousness arises in the first place?
Mm.
And
It's like
that's David
the
Chalmers.
Distinction between the I and the me, made by William James and other people. Like the I is that kind of purely subjective experience of consciousness, and the me is like the object side of consciousness. Like the me includes your thoughts or feelings or desires and so on. So there's the I and the me, and that's... It's like Chalmers also.
That's his terminology.
Between what he calls the hard and soft problems. One is the easy problem is they're looking for the neural correlates of consciousness.
Mm.
And then the hard problem is this issue of the I, which no one's ever been able to resolve.
Well, the Laszlo, you know, quotes all over the place. One of the leading physicists he refers to is Freeman Dyson, who points out that even elementary particles are endowed with a form of or a level of proto-consciousness, as he says.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, in some ways, all matter is conscious, and no consciousness is categorically immaterial. That's what he says here. And if so, there's no categorical divide between matter and mind.
Yeah, that's...
So David Chalmers' hard problem evaporates.
That's kind of consistent with what David Ray Griffin writes in his books, because that's Alfred North Whitehead's position, which is, you know, one thing that they point out, which is a really interesting thing to think about when we're talking about particles, is we're still talking about them as if they're things, as if they're objects.
Yeah.
But he's saying, Whitehead's position was, well, all of these are temporal entities. So as soon as they exist in time, they have the potential on some level to have some level of awareness or consciousness, and therefore the problem evaporates as to this division. And he says that, you know, really, I forget what the term is. It's something beyond panpsychism, but it's like the idea that everything in the universe is on some varying degree of level conscious.
Panpsychism, right. Evolutionary panpsychism.
Yeah. Very, very fascinating kind of. I mean, you know, that's one of the tricks of language, eh? Like when we talk about these things, is we forget these things aren't really things. They're events.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in time more than they are actually objects.
Now, well, I just wanted to read one quick thing, because I think we've been a little unfair to Laszlo. I mean, in this new book, I think you'll agree, he's He's as close as anyone to putting together what he calls an integral theory of everything.
Oh, yeah, he's incredible. He's really interesting.
He says the fact that a high level of consciousness with articulated images, thoughts, feelings, and rich subconscious elements is associated, that is, italicized, associated with complex neural structures, is not a guarantee that such consciousness is due to these structures. Mm-hmm. In other words, the observation that brain function is correlated with consciousness does not ensure that the brain creates consciousness.
Yeah.
It's like the driver and the car again.
Yeah.
He's holding tightly onto the steering wheel, and he's making it go where he wants him to go, but that doesn't mean he was created by the car. So,
and it's funny because when the scientists map what part of the brain is involved in different cognitive functions, what they actually monitor is blood flow. What part of the brain lights up, that's where the consciousness is assumed to be, but that's also where there's increased blood flow.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that consciousness might be related to the blood flow is even supported by their own approaches to the issue.
Yeah.
I like what in Laszlo's work, what I found really fascinating, Odin, was that, and thank you actually for mentioning him, because that motivated me to pick up that book, which I'd forgotten I'd actually purchased and read it, is how he talks about the A field or the Akashic field, and how that's the idea of it being a memory field of what happens universally. Is everything is stored in this field and informs. Well, he talks about, you know, multiple metaverses, universes occurring, but it's so consistent with like Sheldrake's ideas and with David Bohm's ideas. I just want to read a quote. This is from 1931 from Sir James Jinge, the British physicist, who said that today there is a wide measure of agreement, which on the physical side of science approaches almost to unanimity, that the stream of knowledge is heading towards a non-mechanical reality. The universe begins to look more like a great thought than a great machine. Mind no longer appears as an accidental intruder into the realm of matter. We are beginning to suspect that we ought rather to hail it as the creator and the governor of matter. This is in 1931.
Well,
from one of the most, you know, accomplished physicists in the world, and yet 75 years later, we still have this inherent resistance to, as you say, Chris, trying to figure these things out rather than trying to prove them or disprove them. Why don't we try to figure them out, because obviously they exist?
Yeah.
It's like deja vu all over again.
Yeah.
I know Laszlo says the A field effect gives us, this Akashic field gives us, as he says, a simple and logical explanation of the fine-tuned features of our own universe.
Oh.
And one of the most strongest contributions he's making is the very point that Blavatsky makes, which is, as you said, is the holographic nature of the universe and the multiverse, the fact that we're dealing with many, many, many different layers and states of not only matter but consciousness.
Yeah.
So he says that when this universe was born, the bang that created it and the vacuum in which event took place were not randomly configured. So that each universe, and this is really a wonderful insight on his part. Of course, it's not new. This is Blavatsky talking, really. The universe is not new. This is actually, this is Hindu chronology also, that each universe is the result of the prior universe that came before it and is based on it and is configured loosely on it, because we do make progress as we go from universe to universe, but it's a progress based first on a matrix that came from our prior experience. And that's actually simple and logical, because it conforms to our own experience in everyday life. As we go through the stages of childhood and adulthood and old age, or we go through the various, you know, I would say the analogy of a school or a college, we go through various grades. And each grade we get into, we get there because of the progress, the insights that we had in the grade just before it. And we wouldn't be in that grade. We couldn't be in that grade had it not been for the grade before. So
similarly, human beings.
Almost too simple.
Yeah, isn't it amazing, Odin, the example he gives? This is what really excited me when he took the example that Fred Hoyle gives about a blind person trying to do Rubik's Cube. because he says that, I just thought this was extraordinary. He says, you know, if you give a blind person Rubik's Cube and they don't get any feedback on what happens, they have to run through every possible combination, which I think is, the number is 5 times 10 to the 18th. Now, if it takes a person a second to make each move, this blind person, it will take them 126 billion years to run through them all. That's roughly 10 times the age of the universe. However, if you give a blind person feedback, information about the correctness of each move, he can unscramble it in 120 moves, 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Wow. That's so cool, because life is like a Rubik Cube.
Yeah.
We got to all solve our Rubik Cube here.
I would like to ask Richard Dawkins, and Mr. Blind Watchmaker, Mr. Selfish Gene, what makes more sense, that the information is already there and that there's some sort of level of consciousness or everything, or that's all just blind, dumb luck? I mean, you almost have to be willfully ignorant and superstitious to believe, in my mind, to believe that this just all happened accidentally, blindly, randomly, with no information or guidance. This is a completely different kind of way of explaining things. It's not saying like Carl Sagan says about God telling morning glories to open. It's not like that. It's not like God says, hey, morning glory, open. But it's sort of that information or consciousness is inherent in matter and energy.
Yeah, we're waiting for a separate God to come out and make the morning glories open, we will wait 120 billion years.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
I'm so happy that you've got Laswell there, because I wanted to cover more of Laswell at the conference, but we just did not have any one more second to do anything, and what we did do was so extraordinary, I think that speaks for itself.
Yeah, and
we needed another day and a half at least.
Well, perhaps.
Yeah, we could have used another day. It was so full and so many impressions to assimilate. Jim, but we're going to need to let Odin go in a few minutes to move on to our next guest.
I was just going to suggest to Odin that perhaps when we're filling in for Chris, when his daughter's getting married, that perhaps we could talk a bit about Laszlo's work. Because
let's do that.
I find it very, very interesting. And I had questions for Chris about how this, which you partially answered today, about how this relates to Madam's ideas.
Maybe Chris could leave us notes we could work off of.
Okay.
Yeah, and that show is actually October 6th, and you'll also have on with you Robert Bruce, who's written a series of books all on the astral body and astral planes and kind of multidimensional material, which is so widely explored within Blavatsky's work. So maybe those two things might be the focus.
That's going to be an exciting show.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, that'll be really interesting. Okay, thanks, Odin.
Well,
thank you again.
Thank you so much, Christopher, James.
Yeah,
thank you again for the conference.
It's always been my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay.
Have a great day.
Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.
So, any thoughts, Jim? We have a minute here.
A couple million.
How many thoughts can you have on the end of a pin?
Yeah.
Probably about as many as you can have angels.
I just thought that example, it's just incredible from Fred Hoyle. But I just thought that was so compelling, you know, just to think of it in that way. He's just explaining the most basic power of the feedback loop, you know, in information, and it's just
that's a neat example. I mean, it's like other examples showing the kind of improbability of the fine tuning of the universe.
Well, that's
like
what
a universal constant
that's
of
what
nature.
That's what he's using it to illustrate, is how all these constants are so finely tuned that they could, and you know, one of them alone couldn't sort of occur by chance, but the chance of them all occurring is just ridiculous. And he talks about them in quite a bit of detail, and then he provides this example, which I think is really, really interesting.
Yeah.
I think maybe our guest with us.
Okay, so I'll introduce our guest. I assume he's in the background. This is Garrett Rieg, and Garrett is the president of the United Lodge of Theosophy in San Francisco, and has been a longtime student of theosophy, and runs a class out of his home in the Oakland area. And while I was in California. I was fortunate enough to have 3 days there at the Garrett's home, and Garrett had set up a talk for me, several talks, one at his home and one at Unity Church in Walnut Creek. And anyway, I've invited Garrett on as another commentator and a person to share about just about theosophy and how aspects of that. Garrett, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Christopher.
Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm happy to be on line here with you, and I want to thank you for what you did here in the what we call the East Bay of San Francisco. I think it was about 75 people at those two meetings that just got a wonderful inspiration from your presentation of Zero Points and Madame Blavatsky's timeless message.
So, yeah, well, it was odd. I gave such a different talk there in Walnut Creek, more about consciousness and self-remembering and the heart doctrine teaching, and people were so open and receptive.
I think psychology, along with this new physics, is of great fascination to everybody now. We finally realize that, you know, what goes on in our heads is so much more important than what we have or what we do. You know, at least as I get older, I start to realize that, you know, you can have a great career for 30 or 40 years, but at the end of it, what really counts is probably the relationships and the wisdom that you might have gained.
Yeah, I think it's soul qualities that we need through our lives somehow to attain our souls. Gurdjieff uses that expression, that we need to, in a way, strive towards our own self-perfection and, in a way, attain to our soul.
Yes, that's a great thought.
You've been lucky. You've had a theosophical influence through your life, largely. Have you not, Garrett?
I was one of those very lucky people that grew up with two parents who were both active in theosophy. And I'm not sure I would have been automatically inclined to find theosophy, because I'm a very competitive and sometimes a little bit materialistic type person. But I found a great deal of, enlightening ideas and uplifting.
It's like having an anchor in life, or a ballast.
Yes, or a guiding light.
You come back to when life throws you off this way and that, and the kind of waters of life. But you have something you come back to, a teaching, a deeper teaching, which you had through your life then.
Yeah, I think it's great value for me. I love the science of it, you know, and the metaphysics, but the valuable part is really the ethics and the teachings that are about how we relate to people. So that's been some of my focus in the last few years anyway.
Yeah. Do you want to share with listeners maybe something about the background of Blavatsky? Like, she truly was one of the most remarkable figures. I mean, I know of no other figure quite like her. She's quite unique in history.
I think she would be unique in our day, and in her day it was absolutely amazing, the things she did as a woman in the 1850s. You know, she went around the world like three times, long before, the Jules Verne 90 Days Around the World or whatever that was. She had to go by covered wagon the first time she crossed the United States. Later she got to go by train, which was a little easier. She went to India and Tibet several times. She went everywhere, basically, Egypt, you name it. And
yes, she was in Canada, I noticed.
That's right, Canada,
yes,
down to Texas, to Central America, South America.
Yeah.
Because these great teachings have their corollaries, have their echoes in every culture, in every great religion. And, she certainly had some firsthand knowledge of the enormous number of subjects she covered in the secret doctrine. And in ISIS.
Yeah, what an individualist to, like, actually do that, like travel around the world, not with a whole entourage supporting her, but like as an individualist facing that, and everything from the kind of highlands of South America to the caves of Tibet, and at a time where, the world always posed such trouble. like threats and danger to people, but she was a real daring explorer.
Well, there were many times when she came close to death. One time her ship was blown up and only a few of them survived.
Oh.
She was injured in the Revolutionary Wars in Italy with Garibaldi. She rode a horse and fought with him, believe it or not, which doesn't sound very peaceful or spiritual, but, you know, it was a movement for freedom in Italy at the time that was very important. And then she went in circles that were very unusual. I mean, she went from being a concert pianist to having all these adventures and being the only woman outside of a Hungarian countess who was ever admitted to the Freemasons in that century and given the highest awards by the
wow.
London, you know, the top lodge of Freemasonry.
Wow, and she was given an award by the Freemasons.
Yeah, they called it a patent, which gave her the right to basically all levels of Masonic teachings and all lodges.
Wow.
So,
in honor of because, her writings and work. And
yeah, because she did come consciously as a next step sort of after Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
And Theosophy has very deep ties with Freemasons and before them with the Templars. You know, it's an ancient wisdom tradition that has been embodied. Unfortunately, it had to be rather secret for about 1,000 years in the West during the Dark Ages. But
Blavatsky was largely secret today, from my experience.
Well, there are some secret aspects to it still, but
yeah.
Mostly it's a public teaching. The greatest, pretty much the deepest teachings are available at most bookstores or libraries.
Yeah, no, it's funny. It reminds me of, like, Gurdjieff mentions, like, esoteric teachings aren't simply esoteric or hidden because of their not having access to it, but it's like grasping what she was saying. So it
yeah.
strikes me, even though Blavatsky's work's been around, like, in the broader culture, no one has any idea of kind of grasping what she actually said about human beings and her kind of view of the cosmos.
And I would say that her deepest work, The Secret Doctrine, is hard to read for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, it's a process that helps you to discipline and purify your mind as you start to grasp these ideas, because it's not intended for a simple walkthrough. So, you
know, the Secret Doctrine is based on these sets of stanzas of Zen. And Blavatsky claims that these were written in the language of Zenzar, which he says is a language unknown to modern philologists, like people who study language. Do you know much more, Garrett, about, like, the background of those stanzas? I mean, they're so, I mean, what amazing mystical scientific poetry they present.
Yeah, I mean, it's only now that we start to appreciate them with understanding from modern science how, you know, huge this universe is and ancient, and how, you know, things like the Big Bang and the seeding of the universe fit right in with her teachings. But the actual Zenzar, I can't tell you a lot about it. It precedes even Sanskrit. It could be that Indo-Aryan root language that the philologists kind of postulate must be there,
yeah,
that ties languages together. But I do know she's written some about it, but it's not coming to my mind right now. Too
yeah.
bad we don't have Odin on still. He might remember. And
but she wrote, I mean, she was such a remarkable woman. Like, how many books in that did she write? I mean, it's such an extensive library. And what were her major, what would you say are her major works?
Well, of course, her first major work that wasn't just a magazine article was Isis Unveiled. And that's like about two volumes totaling maybe 900 pages, almost as large as The Secret Doctrine.
Yeah, in 1877.
Yes, just
yeah.
imagine back then they were still, you know, going by sailboats around the world, barely had steam power. And this book basically was a compendium of all the world's religions and the science of her day. And it was really focused on the distinction between what you might call white magic and the more negative occult arts, and in the way that religions tend to become organized and calcified and more a political kind of organization than a spiritual one. So she got a lot of criticism for that. And she was also, of course...
She was vilified by the churches, wasn't she, in her day?
Yes, and she also, of course, had a lot of allies in the scientific field, but she also rankled the science world because she was saying there was much more than the material world and much more than just physical evolution. There was spiritual evolution. And so she...
Both. So,
made a lot of waves, but she was very fortunate in the first few years. Thanks to ISIS, she had... Many, many great scientists, follow her and support her. And she quotes many of them in her later books, like The Secret Doctrine. Even Edison was a member of the Theosophical Society.
Oh.
Somebody well known over here.
Yeah.
And many others entertained Theosophic ideas. But after ISIS, she went to India and did a lot of organizing there and helped to bring out appreciation for India's ancient culture. So that there was a greater urge toward putting out books like the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads. But she then started writing again when she settled in London about 1885, and her biggest work, of course, was The Secret Doctrine. I think it was published in 1888.
Yeah.
And that's certainly the most authoritative work, but after that, she put out an easier one to read that's very practical and down-to-earth, accessible, called The Key to Theosophy. And it especially gives us a lot of day-to-day ethics and insights that I like to go back to every few years. And then her most profound, book of sort of like meditation or devotion, would be The Voice of the Silence. And this also was taken from an ancient language or script that she learned, I think, while she was in Tibet. She had to memorize, I think, 90 stanzas. She took 39 of them that wouldn't raise too many eyebrows at that time, and put them into this nice little... very short but very profound book that people still go to for guidance.
I have a copy. I'll read a few verses from The Voice of Silence, if that's okay. Just as we're talking about this, which is kind of Blavatsky's mystical account of the plight of the soul, in a way. She writes, "The mind is the great slayer of the real. Let the disciple slay the slayer. Saith the great law, in order to become the knower of all self, thou hast first of self to be the knower. To reach the knowledge of that self, thou hast to give up self to non-self, being to non-being, and then thou canst repose between the wings of that which is not born nor dies, but is the Om, fundamental sound vibration throughout eternal ages. Give up thy life if thou wouldst live."
Wow. Very profound, and it does stretch the mind. I mean, that's the beautiful part. And it also brings in the heart.
Yeah, I would say that, like, the heart doctrine, and another verse here, it's in The Voice of the Silence, where she says... "The doctrine of the eye is for the crowd, the doctrine of the heart for the elect." So she regards the mystical heart doctrine is embodied in that, The Voice of the Silence. It's quite a wonderful, wonderful work.
Yes.
ISIS unveiled The Secret Doctrine, Keys to Theosophy, and The Voice of Silence. And then she had numerous collected volumes of her work. Isn't there, Garrett?
Yes, in fact, I think it was one of her grandsons, Boris Dzurkov, started collecting them about 1940. or maybe even before World War II. It took like 30 or 40 years to publish them all, a volume or two every year. I think we're up to volume 34, if I recall right.
Wow.
And this is, you know, she was prolific in writing for magazines. She created several magazines herself. Lucifer is the most famous one. And so many of the different theosophical organizations have kind of picked through some of her articles, combined them into little booklets and things. And they live on that way. But the collected works are available, but rather a large, it's like an encyclopedia, truly, 34
yeah.
volumes.
Yeah.
And this, you have to understand, she did all this in the space of 17 years.
Wow.
She established the Theosophical Society in 1875.
1875. That was in New York City, wasn't it?
That's right. She came specifically to the United States because it was the most advanced at that time in terms of free speech and freedom of religion. And purposely started there, but then after 3 years went to India, which was sort of her spiritual homeland. And that became the world headquarters were then switched to India for what still remains and is called the Theosophical Society.
Oh, so, that's the head of the Theosophical Society today.
Yes,
they call it that society. And
sometimes to distinguish, that is the oldest society, and it's split up into several different groups or organizations. But we often say Theosophical Society Adyar, which is this suburb in southern India, suburb of Madras. I forget the new name for Madras. A beautiful place, a wonderful place to visit. But their headquarters in the United States is in Wheaton. So we also say Theosophical Society Wheaton.
Oh, yeah.
And that's to be distinguished from the Theosophical Society in America, if I recall right, which has headquarters in Pasadena, and which was trying to be more loyal to Blavatsky after she died than the Theosophical Society itself. And then, of course, about the same time was established the United Lodge of Theosophists, which I'm very active in. And that was a fellow named Robert Crosby who established that. So we have those three easily identified organizations, about five or six more that are sort of splinters of her original movement. And then you have her teachings reflected and studied very often by Rosicrucians, Masons, I forget the name, the Golden Dawn, something of the Golden Dawn. There's a number of groups that are still close to...
People interested in, like, the occult sciences and esotericism.
Yeah, she tends to be, you know, when people want to really get deep and really to the roots of the modern expression, they usually find Blavatsky at some point.
Yeah, find their way to her. Yeah. Who is the group who... They publish such beautiful editions of Isis and the Secret Doctrine, and they do it so inexpensively. That's a Theosophical University Press?
Yes. In fact, that's part of the second organization I mentioned. I think they call themselves Theosophical Society in America.
Yeah.
Because they were the American section that broke off. There was a dispute between the sort of lieutenants of Blavatsky after she died. And William Hugh Judge was in charge of the American section and was really the spiritual disciple and partner of Blavatsky.
Yeah.
And so his group separated. And they have a wonderful library. It's almost like a museum down in Pasadena. And they also have their printing house, which puts out wonderful books, many, many books. The Theosophy Company also publishes a lot of editions, sometimes more focused on economy and exact replicas rather than beauty. But that's in Los Angeles, and that's part of the affiliated with the United Lodge. So there's many, many different groups, and we all tend to coordinate at certain times. We have people from all those organizations at the international conference. And
Yeah, it was nice seeing people from different backgrounds. Nice fellow met from Wheaton or Chicago area who came down, and that was nice about the... It seemed to me at the conference that there was a unanimity among people that the divisions in the theosophical societies, there was a need to kind of get back together and kind of look at that a bit and be open, you know, sharing between lodges and societies more. Would you agree? Did you have a sense of that?
Yes, I think that's an important observation. It's something that we've been thinking about, especially since 1975, when we had expected to have a new message, and it wasn't obvious what that message was. And so there is certainly a greater feeling of camaraderie. I and many people belong to two or three or more theosophic groups.
Yeah.
And there's no conflict there. They all have a little different emphasis and, different social styles. So
yeah.
it's a good situation now. It's quite positive.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I've been invited to New Zealand to a conference there. I'm not really sure. I think they're a TS society.
It would be the TS, I'm quite sure.
Yeah.
And that is the larger worldwide society, the original one. I think ULT, if it has anything in New Zealand, it's just one lodge.
Mm-hmm.
So that should be a great trip. I hope you can get
I hope I get to it. I don't know. I haven't figured it out yet.
Well, it's as far as you can go on the other side of the world, so.
Yeah, a lot of
ways to get to. But your message is very important, you know, because it's. Blavatsky almost went out of circulation in 1910 or so. And the last 20 years, she has been much more popular because of science kind of catching up to her.
Yeah.
And psychology as well. I mean, as bad as psychology may be and as materialistic as it is, it's certainly better than pure materialism. People, you know, think about their minds and potentially by extension their souls. That's a great start. You know, we had three objects in the original society. And one is investigating the psychic powers latent in man. And you know, a lot of what we call psychic powers, we use every day just in our thinking, in our intentions, in our hopes and fears. And science and psychology may be exploring that somewhat from a physical point of view, but they inevitably end up learning more and more that we are more than the brain. We're more than our three dimensions would tell us. So, I just think this century, as Blavatsky said, a lot of these ideas would flower. And,
we realize now, like science has been showing now the psychical nature of human beings, like all the evidences for all the varied paranormal phenomena. So now science has kind of verified that these things exist. So now we need more a model of how they work. And that's also what Blavatsky provides, is like a higher dimensional models and ideas about the different planes of existence and rounds and races and root races. I mean, she covers everything in her work.
Yeah, I think the most important ideas that Piazzi really wanted to bring to the West was what had been lost in the Dark Ages, and that is the ideas of reincarnation and more detail about karma, or how there really is justice in the world. Because, you know, we have a lot of people who get very depressed and worried and frightened, and a lot of suicides because people don't see any hope.
Yeah.
They see only the material world, and they see it going bad for them, and they give up. And Theosophy is, you know, a doctrine of hope, because we are eternal and we're part of the universe, you know, and we have this connection that is so fantastic in our, well, you would say in the zero point of our heart.
I think people lose heart, like they fall into despair and just feel a lot of emptiness in the heart and get disheartened. I think it's all like that science of the heart is so important, you know.
Well, and that's it. I mean, theosophy tries to combine not just the sentimental part of the heart, you know, but also we even though we say the heart doctrine is superior to the head doctrine, we use our heads a lot, okay? And we get to our heart sometimes by having a concept in our head, if that makes sense. So I think the beauty of theosophy is it combines so many things. You know, it combines science and religion. It combines psychology, philosophy, sociology even. It's just universal.
Yeah.
And the more you make these connections between different disciplines, the deeper I think you get. You start to see what's behind them. And so right now we're in an age where people are not going to have blind faith. They know too much. They have educations. They learn what science is teaching. And they have to have something that's deep enough to be convincing, that has explanations and reason. And you may need a little bit of faith to extend your vision, so to speak, but essentially theosophy gives you a structure for understanding yourself and the universe.
Yeah. Yeah, and in a much broader scheme, like even through races and early history, and I mean, it's such a panoramic view that Blavatsky provides, you know, addressing all these kind of mysteries of life, like, you know, the mysteries of these different places and Atlanteans and, you know, these different earlier races and time periods. And she's such a remarkable woman, how she kind of leaps and bounds mm-hmm. across human history, you know.
Right. And I do believe that if we get an idea of how we have all these different vehicles or dimensions within each of us, that we start to understand, you know, how we reflect so many different emotions, and we learn to look at ourselves and to be able to transcend some of our emotional negative times, for example.
Yeah.
And understanding that we're an eternal being that's reincarnated many times, suddenly you realize, well, maybe, you know, some of this is a reflection from my last life, and, you know, that may help us to understand why things may seem complicated or depressing to us.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to believe in karma. It's very nice to believe that somehow justice is eventually inherent to the universal structure. I mean, I think there's a physics to how karma actually works. There has to be.
Oh, yes. And, you know, if you don't have a belief that the world is just, you're going to be so angry and so depressed. I mean, you know, somebody cuts you off. You know, they do something that looks mean to you, you're going to react. But if you realize, well, that's just, you know, another part of myself, and that we all have these, you know, negative attributes that we have to transcend, you can kind of take it and not overreact. But if you see yourself as just, you know, this little piece of body and flesh that's going to die in 60 or 70 years, and that you're just a machine that's here to get, you know, some sense pleasures, maybe some power, a little sex, you know, whatever you limit
yourself. Yeah, money, sex, and power, they say, are the three motives associated with the three lower chakras.
And that,
sex and power.
And that's what usually brings most of the suffering in the world. It makes us feel separate.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with, you know, money, sex, and power. They're all useful.
Yeah.
They're tools. They're enjoyable, even. But if we think that's all we are, then we're really in a bad place, because we can't always be on the top of the roost, and eventually we're going to lose our you know, health and vitality and die.
Yeah.
And what then?
Yeah.
No wonder
you can't take much over with you.
But if you see that you're storing up wisdom and knowledge that you're never going to lose, and that's your real self, those are your treasures in heaven.
Yeah, those qualities can be built into your soul in a way, in your soul's progress.
Yeah, so then it makes life kind of a joy, because every day you're, you know, learning something, adding something, and it's not going to be lost. Even if you forget it in your next life, it's going to be part of your character.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if you have a terrible experience this sounds a little cruel sometimes, but you try to turn it around and say, well, was there a lesson from that? And do I need to be here? Because one of the hardest things to realize is, according to theosophy, pretty much everything we get, we deserve. It may not be because of what we did consciously in this life, but somehow it's there for our own spiritual evolution.
Yeah.
And if you've lost your legs from an accident or the war or whatever, you know, if you're not going to have a really bitter outlook on the world, a faith, and especially a reasonable, rational one like theosophy, is a great, great support, I think. And, you know, you break up with your girlfriend, especially when you're young, you think it's the end of the world. You know, philosophy in general, or theosophy, gives you that perspective that, you know, you are not just your little circumstances, that you're going to have good and bad, and that you're not a loser if something goes wrong. So I think it's a great
it's an inspiring philosophy, though. We kind of work our way up through different rounds of evolution, through different kingdoms of nature even, and then into kind of human, and then attain these higher levels of human psychical and spiritual attainment. I mean, it's such a rich, deep philosophy of life to have some concept of such things as that.
Well, it's the first ecology. You know, Blavatsky wrote probably 80 years before the environmental movement started in the United States, but her most important idea was that, as you mentioned earlier in the program, every part of the universe is infused with consciousness or deity.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly applies to the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom. And we came up through those kingdoms. There are little brothers and little sisters. And we were once in those life forms. So when you go out to your garden and you're communing and loving those plants, I mean, it's a very natural thing. And it fits in with this holistic view of the universe that I think is another gift that we get. And, you know, any theosophist is a natural ecological thinker, because it's our function to see not just brotherhood among men, but the unity of all life. And, you know, it's...
One example of this that just comes to mind for me is, I love the analogy of, like, you take a seed, like, say, for a plant, and you put it in your garden, and you put it in the soil, and then you add water, and then it needs air, and then it needs sun. And it's like those four elements combined in that, the air, water, earth, and fire combined in that, in the growth of that seed into becoming a plant. And similarly, a human being, in a way, we grow up through these elementary kingdoms, and within ourselves, there are levels of our own being.
Yeah.
So we have the physical nature, the emotional nature, the intellectual, mental nature, and then we have the spiritual nature. So it's like we have those elements within ourselves.
And isn't it a much richer, more wonderful universe to see it all that way?
Yeah.
I mean, there's all these dimensions, and we can relate to everything. I think somebody said all it takes to be a theosophist is to believe in brotherhood and to be an independent thinker. In other words, you were talking earlier about learning about the self, you know, looking inward. And I think theosophy impels us and guides us to a very rewarding inner search. And I just see more and more people in our Western culture are turning in that direction.
Yeah, it's neat because it's not like it's not a dogma. I don't like the dogma. It's too much. I mean, it's a teaching, and we have to strive to understand it. It's not a dogma you got to kind of believe in, you know, like it's not like that. It's a teaching.
Yeah, the teaching is so deep and broad that, you know, there's no room for dogma. I mean, you know, and part of the idea is that we are limited beings and we can't quite grasp the entire nature of the universe. We can get kind of a partial view, but whatever we see is going to be incomplete unless we're in some state of super high consciousness like samadhi. So it gives us a certain humility and means that if somebody else doesn't see the world the way we do, we can respect that. We can still love them, honor them, and be brotherly with them.
Yeah.
So we see the different religions. They definitely have different, you know, cultural values. Most of their values are very similar. I mean, most religions teach kindness and thoughtfulness and, you know, the value of friends, family, community, and so on.
Yeah.
But they differ so much in the little rituals and the things that are, I would say, more localized, that sometimes people feel that they are, you know, they don't like those other religions. For a long time, Westerners felt they were superior in both their politics and their religion. So Theosophy was a great counterweight to the Age of Empire when it came out. Because Blavatsky said, wait a minute, you know, I don't mind teaching the princes and the maharajas in India, but I'm also going to be teaching the untouchables. And
yeah.
She gave great inspiration to, like, Mahatma Gandhi.
Yeah, like a humanitarian.
In fact, you know, Gandhi
teaching. Didn't
even appreciate his own religious teachings or culture until he read The Key to Theosophy.
Oh, really?
He was astounded to realize that there were theosophists in London who were studying with great intensity the Bhagavad Gita.
Oh, yeah.
And he hardly had ever read it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, really.
And he suddenly realized that, you know, he didn't have to be embarrassed about being an Indian or a Hindu.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so it's
really fun to see these historical currents, because for us, Gandhi is a great hero. He embodied a lot of theosophic ideals.
Garrett, at one point you were going to say three of something, and you got the first one. We never got to the next two.
Well,
why don't we maybe share those, and then we'll open it up. Jim's there in the background, might have some comments. The first was to study this, the nature of the psychic faculty in human beings.
Actually, that's the number third one. I probably got disorganized a little bit, and it doesn't particularly matter the order, but you know, every organization likes to have a mission statement or some goals, and so the original three objects were, the first one was to form a nucleus of universal brotherhood in all countries and across all genders. There was no discrimination on race, ethnic origin, or anything like that, or certainly sex.
Yeah.
Which was a new thing, and probably a good third of the leaders of Theosophy in those days, maybe even the majority, were women.
Yeah.
The second object, after brotherhood, was to study all the religions and sciences.
Yeah.
Together, to scientifically study religion and to study science with at least a mystical or religious insight.
Yeah.
That would be the second object. The third object, then, was the study of the psychic, maybe she said psychic and noetic powers in man.
So and noetic meaning knowing, like, psychic and knowing.
More spiritual thing, because psychic can be very low. You can have psychic experiences that are very selfish, that are very dangerous, really.
Yeah.
And in fact, that last object was very controversial. Blavatsky, after about 8 years, declared she would no longer do any psychic phenomena because they were being misinterpreted, and people were flocking just to try to see something miraculous happen, which is terrible from her point of view, because, you know, these were only little examples to pique people's curiosity.
Yeah, and the deeper element is the spiritual metaphysical teaching. And
even more important than the spiritual metaphysical was the ethical side. So they did, in a sense, de-emphasize. We study these things. We don't usually practice them, especially not publicly.
Yeah.
You know, we may have some things like, you know how people use the muscles to get what they think are psychic answers for health? I've seen that done in a Theosophy meeting once.
Oh, testing.
Yeah,
PK testing.
Yeah, that's. But in terms of...
Yeah, it's very interesting.
We do not go in for seances. Occasionally we help people to, you know, get rid of hauntings. But typically we think our work is more to learn and to practice basic brotherhood than
yeah.
anything else.
And comparative studies of religion, psychology, religion, science, and philosophies, that's all kind of so... embodied in Blavatsky's work.
Yes, and you're continuing that one in great, great measure. Your books are exactly in that area.
Yeah.
They cover the whole spectrum, of course, but I think this is important because the world right now, even though we have these religions that are fairly strong in the United States still and around the world, the usual final authority for people is science more and more. And to have credibility, you have to be keyed into the scientific world or take it into account.
Yeah.
You know, I notice nowadays when there's a disaster, like a mass shooting or something, it's not just the ministers, but they usually call in a bunch of psychologists to counsel the students, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So science or psychology has certainly equal, if not much heavier, weight even on a day-to-day basis for most people in our culture. People may go to church, but when they have a crisis, they go to a therapist. Just as often as they go to a minister or a chaplain. So it's important for Theosophy to be not only mystical, but also up-to-date on science.
Yeah, practical, everyday help and guidance and such, yeah. Why don't we turn it over, Jim? Any comments or anything you would like to pick up on?
You're talking about Madame Blavatsky, as I know a fair amount about her life, but just as Garrett was reviewing it, it's just an incredible life. And as he said, you know, 17 years that she packed an unbelievable amount of experience, and she was an incredible writer in terms of, you know, being prolific, and all these things are going on. I mean, didn't mention too the whole experience in India and her involvement in the Indian nationalistic movement, and I mean, it's just such a rich life. I mean, you know, even before the suffragette movement, I think was in the teens and the 20s, at the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, she was the prototypical feminist. I mean, if she's the grandmother of the New Age, she is also sort of the grandmother of modern feminism, too, because she was just, like, such an extraordinary figure in that, in so many, by so many different standards.
And empowered, then, that whole suffragette women's movement. In England and India, Jim.
Jim, I like that idea because, you know, she, in a sense, changed things by example. You know, this woman, there was no glass ceiling, there was no brass ceiling for her. She was, you know, conversant with the greatest minds in every field in her day.
Yeah.
Science, religion, even to some extent, some of the political leaders.
Yeah, one of the things I like about in her writing too, and in her presentation of things, and then we touched on this before, Chris, but is there's an authority to the way she presents things. She's not arguing with people. She's just saying, you know, look, this is the way it is, but not in a dogmatic way. And it's like, you know, you have to look into this, investigate, and discover this for yourself. And science is going to come to these points of view. Not now, but they will. And she's been, you know, she's been, I think without doubt that she's been vindicated, I was interested by Garrett's comment that she had kind of faded at one point, and that's really just in the last 20 years that there's been sort of a revitalization. I didn't realize that, and I think that's kind of really interesting and really exciting. And I mean, in a sense, Chris, like, I can see why theosophists would be very excited by your work and by your presentations, because I think you've really brought it into a contemporary context, both in terms of psychology, but also other areas of science, especially physics and cosmology, and then with the spiritual aspect too of your teaching. It's a really interesting synthesis, and I think.
Yeah.
somewhere Madam's probably smiling on you and quite happy with you. So
yeah, I think she does it.
Yeah,
for sure.
Go get them.
Different periods in my life, I felt her presence and influence and such.
I was going to, oh, actually, when Odin was speaking earlier, you know, he made a remark about her not really being dead. And
yeah.
I don't know if you remember this, Chris, but in 1975, I believe, near the end of his life, Henry Miller was interviewed by Jonathan Cott for Rolling Stone magazine, and he described an experience. He was reading Blavatsky's books in the 30s when he was living in Paris.
Wow, Miller was. Wow.
Yeah, and when he was reading the books, he said he had a really bizarre experience, which was they were talking about awakening, and he said, yeah, I was reading her books, and suddenly I had a vision of her as if she was actually in the room.
Oh, yeah. Really?
And he said, you know, like I was looking at her face, and I was kind of mesmerized by it, and he said, and then it kind of struck me that all my life I had been blaming others and looking to others for excuses for how I was, and I realized that I was totally responsible for myself, and therefore I was totally free. And he said, you know, in a way, I think that was a moment of awakening for me in terms of my entire life, and you know, he related that directly.
Wow, to that experience.
To that experience and to reading her books, which is really, you know, quite interesting, to say the least. I mean, I don't know how many modern scientists are going to have that effect on people 60 or 70 years after they're dead, you know.
Well, I do think my writing does, in a way, contemporize Blavatsky's work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I looked at the alternative literature on comparative studies of the secret doctrine of modern science, most of it kind of ended in 1950, you know, and really, oh no, there was a good symposium, 1984. Actually, which was good. And my work kind of, I thought, updated, like, just how remarkable these parallels are from Blavatsky to modern physics and cosmology. And they're astonishing, in fact, all the way up to the newest holographic models, and especially the newest holographic model. So I hope that my work does serve that kind of purpose and, you know, getting people to see, interpret aspects of the secret doctrine at a deeper level, even, you know, in the zero point teaching and looking at her concepts of the nature of the ethers and so on, you know.
I'd like to mention on that point that, Christopher, you're probably the first one who's gone so deeply into science and explicitly the secret doctrine. We do have some great theosophists who are physicists. One of them has written several books that reflect theosophy and physics, but he rarely gives credit to Blavatsky. For example, you know from the movie What the Bleep, Amit Goswami?
Yeah, I've read his books, several of them.
Yeah. You know, he's a theosophist, but he doesn't quote Blavatsky, rarely if at all.
It's funny, I see his teaching as inconsistent with my interpretation of the secret doctrine.
I do see some points where he's, yeah.
I mean, I'd have to reread his books, and in a way, yeah.
But he at least has, I mean, the subtitle of one of his books is How Consciousness Creates the Material World.
It's funny, I don't see consciousness as creating the physical world.
Ultimate consciousness, I agree. Yeah.
I see Purusha and Prakriti. To me, it's like, in my room at the moment, I have a light source, and the light of that illuminates all these different objects. So the light is like consciousness, and it illuminates the material world. But I don't expect the light from my light to move things in the material world. It just illuminates them. That's how I see consciousness, is like light.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see consciousness as doing the creating. I see the modes of nature and Prakriti in its forms as the creation, like the material side. So I don't see I don't quite understand that. I mean, I think they both emerge out differentiations of the divine lux, which kind of manifests as dual aspect. That's just a bit what I most disagreed with in Goswami's book. I don't think it's correct kind of to say consciousness creates reality.
Yeah, well, I mean,
but
there's different ways of looking at it, and I understand you are looking at the ultimate consciousness, the absolute reality of the universe, and that is our best simile for it, and probably in actuality, is light. I mean, light is this amazing, magical, spiritual thing.
Yeah.
But, and taking it that way, I can agree. On the other hand, for any scientist to say that consciousness has a role in the material world, especially, you know, prior to quantum mechanics, was quite a breakthrough.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah, well, yeah, science,
all these people are going in the right direction. They're saying there's something more than just the three or five.
And they realize that somehow the consciousness of the observer has to be brought into the equation, because the states and intentions and mental processes of observers affect the nature of the particles they examine. So it's not that everything exists independently of the process of observation. So that general concept's really important in Goswami's books and other things on the new physics.
Well, it's great mind-expanding ideas.
Yeah.
Well,
I noticed we're just going to have a few minutes here. Maybe we should... thank you, Gareth, for coming on and sharing some of the kind of background, the kind of principles of theosophy, and about Blavatsky's background and her varied writings. And we've had the opportunity to discuss some kind of the practical aspect of, you know, having bringing theosophy into your life as an ethical teaching. And yeah, so thanks to Gareth for sharing, and we'll hope that. Have you back some other time in the future as we continue to share some theosophical discussions.
Very good. I look forward to that.
Okay. Thanks, Kurt.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks, Kurt.
Goodbye. Jim.
Yep.
Yeah, so we should take a moment. Any final notes? We've got a minute or two here. Okay, so we got to close up quick.
My thought is goodbye.
Okay,
thanks very much.
This has been Zero Point Radio. Great. Back in 2 weeks' time. Thanks for listening.
Okay,
thanks Odin and Garrett and Jim Moffat. Goodbye.
Bye.